Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes the best-selling author of Plum Island and Nightfall, Nelson DeMille, whose blistering new novel, The Cuban Affair, features an exciting new character, U.S. Army combat veteran Dan Mac McCormick, now a charter boat captain about to set sail on his most dangerous cruise. Monday, September 25th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 299 for Thursday, the 21st day of September 2017. Donald Trump met Jordan's King Abdullah in New York on Wednesday and praised his country for taking in Syrian refugees. At the UN on Tuesday, Trump praised Turkey and Lebanon for taking in refugees too. This coming from a man who, as a candidate for president, said Syrian refugees in the United States would be sent back home, insinuating that these homeless people, many of them women and children and the elderly, posed a threat to national security. As president, Trump has lowered the number of refugees the United States accepts annually, and according to news reports, some in his administration want to lower the number even further. Asked to justify this reduction in the nation's generosity and mercy, the Trump administration falls on arguments about the cost of providing refugees with benefits once they settle in the United States. The wealthiest country in the world simply can't afford to take as many refugees as we used to, they say. But according to the New York Times, an internal government study found that refugees brought in $63 billion more in government revenues than they cost over a recent decade. That is, while refugees receive government benefits once they arrived in the United States, they also found work and started contributing taxes within a relatively short period. A draft of that report was obtained by The Times, which reported that Trump administration officials rejected its findings. The hardliners in the administration, led reportedly by Chief Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, were only interested in what refugees cost the government, not what their financial contributions were in the period covered in the study, which was from 2005 to 2014. Of course, the report just doesn't fit with Trump's anti-immigrant America First posture. So on the show today, a focus on the refugee crisis caused by the now six-year-old civil war in Syria. Millions of people are living in refugee camps. Some have died seeking refuge. We have two guests to meet today, one of whom is coming to Maryland with his Arabic music ensemble to perform a concert and bring attention to the Syrian refugee crisis. We'll hear about the music of Layali from one of its founders and performers, Michelle Mushabek. Also on the show, Alia Malik, an attorney, author, journalist, and daughter of Syrian immigrants. Alia Malik, who grew up in Baltimore, traveled to Damascus in the spring of 2011 as the country disintegrated into brutal civil war, causing the uprooting of millions of people. She's written a book about Syria and her family, and she spent time among refugees from the war. She'll be joining us in just a few minutes. First up, here's book critic Paula Gallagher with this week's recommended reading, a novel set in the rural South, and says Paula, deserving high praise.
Dan, this week's novel is Sing Unburied, Sing by Jessamyn Ward. Her previous novel, Salvage the Bones, won the 2011 National Book Award, so this is a highly anticipated novel, and it's one that really cements her place as a masterful American novelist. It's the story of a Mississippi family struggling both internally and externally, and she gives us 13-year-old JoJo, who is being raised in poverty in this Mississippi shack by his loving grandparents. JoJo is essentially himself raising his toddler sister, Kayla. This is an African-American family. However, JoJo and Kayla's father is white, and he's in prison. What sets this story in motion is that their father, Michael, is about to get out of prison, and it's a story of the mundane, the sickness, the hunger, to the larger reaching themes of profound effects of racism and brutality. Ward does not shy away from giving you really detailed descriptions of the hunger, of the sickness of these characters, of the things they're afraid of, the things that they hope for. Her rich language and insights into human nature make this a book to read slowly and savor, although the circumstances are often painful and brutal. Not only do you have, you know, this intense sense of realism, she's also playing with the surreal and maybe a little bit of magical realism in that there are characters that are the unburied. These are characters that are ghosts, literally. The maternal side of the family has this ability to be able to either hear, in the sense of the grandmother can hear spirits. Jojo and his mother, they both have the ability to see these people. So it gives you a lot of layers of richness. These are characters that will stay with you. I rarely, in reading a novel weeks later, remember the names of characters, and I did with this book. These are characters that got into my psyche that I'm still carrying with me. It's a story of longing, desperation, and love. Beautifully written. Highly recommend. I think this is something that's destined to become a classic. Great book for book clubs. Again, it is Sing, Unburied Sing by Jessamyn Ward.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County system. She joins us once a week to recommend a book for our listeners. Speaking of books, the Baltimore Book Festival happens this weekend at the Inner Harbor. One of the many authors scheduled to speak at the festival is civil rights lawyer and journalist Alia Malik, author of The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir about Syria, its history and politics, its culture, and about her family. Alia Malik has spent time with Syrian refugees and written about them. We start with an easy question. How does she see the civil war in Syria playing out? Is it finally coming to an end?
I think it is, to some extent, coming to an end at the moment. There's obviously been a shift in the rhetoric that's coming from the countries who had most fervently been calling for Assad, the current dictator, to step down. And there's clearly a sort of transition towards normalizing his presence and accepting his presence, at least in the short term. That's what appears to be happening now. It looks like the regime is going to consolidate its control over the territories that it has while also trying to bring into control the territories that it lost. It's backed by two very powerful countries, Iran and Russia. And the powerful countries that had been sort of pushing the rebellion from the other side, the Turks, the Saudis, seem to have sort of withdrawn a lot of that support. There's only really a lot of focus by those powers on curtailing as much as possible the power of ISIS, the so-called Islamic State. So that's what looks like is going to happen in the short term. As for all the millions of people who have been displaced, whether internally or externally, it looks like a lot of them are not going to be going home anytime soon. Where you're really going to see the change will be inside the country, where there's been a kind of demographic cleansing of certain places. But it looks like the way that we're going now is, we're going to normalize and accept that the regime gets to stay in power for now, because there's sort of been a decision made, which is a naive one, but a decision made that the dictator in the suit that you know is better than the crazy extremists in the beard that you don't know, even though they're in a completely symbiotic relationship and one exists because of the other. When the way that you determine your politics is based on what is most convenient in the short term, or the friend, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind mm-hmm. of philosophy, as opposed to a real coherent sort of sense of justice and and fairness for everybody in the region, then that's why you sort of end up in these weird kinds of situations where we're fighting on the one side sometimes against Assad, and on the other times we're fighting, you know, with him. So there are these different, these are the sort of like mutant outcomes that you get when your decision-making process is based on, you know, convenience or, you know, on these short-term, short-sighted sort of ideas of what is in our best interest, as opposed to having a sort of philosophy that says, in this region, everybody who belongs to the region should sort of be able to live in a state that provides for their security and their safety and their equality as citizens without any kind of qualification based on ethnicity or sect or religion. And unfortunately, we never look at these things in a comprehensive sense. We sort of are always looking at them as little fires that we want to put out. And listen, the ISIS guys are very good at making themselves as scary as possible. They produce these horrible videos. They, you know, they sort of embrace the most technicolor kind of violence that's out there. And that can be misleading. That can make us think that, okay, these guys who are in suits on the other end are the guys that we can play with. When, in fact, you know, the sort of authoritarian dictatorships that we've seen over the last years have very much laid the groundwork for these sorts of actors to be able to come in, aided and abetted by the kind of chaos that the United States introduced into the region by invading Iraq.
It's kind of hard to imagine the U.S. accepting a war criminal like Assad down the road. It's just hard to imagine him staying in power, but I think you're right.
I think he does. Have.
Yeah.
I don't think you have to imagine it.
You say in your book, The Home That Was Our Country, that it was, I don't know if you used the word naive, but it was kind of a naive belief that the Arab Spring would trickle into Syria and that naturally Syria was next in line to see a revolution.
Yeah, in 2011, I was, like many people, sort of buoyed by a kind of optimism as to what was happening in the region. And I always suspected that Syria was going to be much more difficult because there were differences in the way the regime was entrenched in Syria than, for example, what the situation that you had in Egypt. And those differences were obvious. And so many of us who were sort of Syria watchers didn't think Syria would give way at all as easily as the other places. Let's just say the sort of best instincts and the best currents that were emerging in 2011 were the ones that were not the most strengthened and enabled and aided by the different international actors acting badly or goodly at different points at different times. I mean, there were a lot of chefs in the stew or mm-hmm. chefs in the kitchen at that point.
Well, one of them was President Obama, who people consider a player in this and who didn't, you know, follow through on his threat. I mean, you hear this a lot now. There's a lot of whataboutism that goes on these days with Trump in office and his supporters mm-hmm. saying, well, what about this and what about that? And one of the whatabouts is, what about Obama's line in the sand on Syria? And then I always say to people, well, what do you think we should have done? Mm-hmm. Should we have invaded Syria to support the rebellion?
So that's a good question. Basically, the thing that I always tell people is that in our toolkit, you know, as world power or as any power that sort of as any kind of nation state who has to interact in this world and sort of like global system, in your toolkit, you have many different tools. Invasion is kind of one of the bigger ones. You have a lot of things that you can do before invasion. And so I think what President Obama could have done was that it was very clear from early on that one of the reasons the Syrian regime was able to withstand the internal pressure that it was getting from its own people, who were asking initially for reforms, not even for regime change, was that they had a very powerful player backing them, and that was the Iranian government. The Iranian government was propping up the regime financially and militarily as well. So if I'm President Obama in 2011 and I know I'm trying to negotiate this massive nuclear deal with Iran and Iran is the one pulling the strings in Syria, so, you know, what's in my toolkit? I have this deal. I have leverage that I can be asking for something, because as much as Obama wanted to secure that deal, the Iranians want it back into the world system. They've got a lot of caviar to sell. They've got a lot of great cities that could use some Western tourism dollars. I mean, Iran wanted back in. So why not ask for something in exchange on behalf of Syrians at that time? And that, you know, to me, that was one of the bigger failings of President Obama. And then the other major player that emerged in Syria was Russia. And Russia was very much not happy with what had gone down in Libya, to the extent that the Americans sort of misled as to what they were going to be doing in Libya. And Russia also had the situation going on in the Ukraine. So the United States was working with European partners to have sanctions. There was leverage also to be used against Russia. All of these things would have happened way before any kind of invasion. So I just want people to remember that there are other things, other tools in our toolkits. And I think, you know, the tools that we decide to use when it comes to countries like that are in the Middle East, that are Arab or Muslim dominated, are not the ones that we would ask, you know, that we would use on our own friends or use on people who we imagine to be like us and that we imagine don't want chaos. And that's part of the reason that I wrote the book, because there's this like massive, we think there's this massive chasm between who quote-unquote we are and who quote-unquote they are. You know, I think that's part of the reason that we respond to events in the Middle East only by talking right away, like, how do we change the regime and how do we do it militarily? And we sort of lose our ability to imagine much more broadly, which is what I think we would have done if, say, were Italy that were in this situation, or England as it was going through Brexit. Did we arm anybody on the opposite side of Brexit? I mean,
right.
There are other ways to sort of get people to the table and get people to do things that we want them to do.
Could you describe a little bit some of your experiences with refugees? You wanted to immerse yourself among the refugees after the crisis had developed, now affecting somewhat 11 million people, some internally in Syria, some outside of Syria. So where did you go and what were your experiences like?
Well, first, let me just say that the entire condition of refugees is something that's very well known to the Middle East from well before this current crisis. And Syria, in fact, is a country that has over the last century hosted many refugees, starting with the victims of the Armenian genocide. Those people who were able to survive the genocide found refuge in Syria, and there isn't a single person from what was Western Armenia who didn't pass through Syria, even if they went on to Lebanon or Argentina or the other centers of Western Armenian diaspora. Mm. And then Syria absorbed many of the Palestinian refugees. It absorbed many Iraqi refugees. It absorbed many Lebanese refugees during the war. So, like, in Syria, we know what it is for people to lose their homes and to need to be welcomed by people. And Syrians have done that for a century. So it is, you know, with great irony that we have watched what has happened to the Syrians today. So to this specific crisis, in September of 2015, I was, you know, on massive deadline for this book, but I was watching what was happening. You know, I was already back in the U.S. and watching all these Syrians make their way across the sea. And I know to a lot of people, they look like invading hordes, but to me, they looked like people who were acting with an incredible amount of agency, who had sort of said they were rejecting both the regime and those other extremists that would replace the regime. They were sort of saying, we are not going to be part of this. We will, you know, we will give everything up to kind of try to have a future somewhere else. So in September 2015, 2 years ago, more or less around now, with a Magnum photographer, we went to Bodrum, Turkey, and started interviewing smugglers and meeting people as they were getting ready to leave. And then we went to Kos. We went right across the Aegean to a Greek island. And we're just observing this massive phenomena of people showing up every morning. And I was in a garden where I saw a group of Syrians who I couldn't really figure out how they fit together. They had different accents. There was a coastal accent. There was an inland accent. There was a Damascus accent. There were people who were wearing hijab. There were girls who were women who were in shorts. There were children. There were these two guys who were together, who very Laurel and Hardy. Like, one was large and strapping, and the other one was like this small little skinny guy. And I was just trying to understand how all these people fit together. So I started talking to them, and I found out that they had all just met on the raft because their raft had broken down in the middle of the sea. And these were the 11 that had kind of worked together, even while everybody else was panicking and freaking out and, you know, turning on each other. These 11 had kind of worked together to get everybody to shore. And at that point, you had to spend about 6 days on a Greek island before they let you go on. So they were sticking together. And I asked them if I could accompany them on their journey. And they allowed us to. So I made the journey with them, getting to Germany about 2 weeks later. And that story is chronicled in this collaboration between me, a graphic novelist, and the photographer in Foreign Policy. Is this beautiful 16-page spread. It's called The Road to Germany, $2,400. And that's based on a map. A lot of them, it's not even a map. It looks like a kid's sort of diagram that everybody had on their smartphone. And I've been back 6 months into their new lives, 1 year, and I just got back from the two-year anniversary trip. So it has been...
So Germany.
Germany, Sweden, yeah. And Holland. No, they've ended up in three different places.
Three different places.
And it's been kind of fascinating to watch what's happening there. And it is fascinating to be in Germany, you know, which I...
You mean that's been so accepting of these refugees?
Yes, which, yeah. But had been once upon a time
like,
so
like
fascist.
A million, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Contrast that with what's happened here with the Trump administration asking to reduce the number of refugees that we take into something like... I think Stephen Miller and his administration wants the number to be 15,000. They want to trim the Obama-era number from 120 to 50,000 or something like that. It's very depressing to be an American and hear a president talk about reducing, pulling back on our generosity toward refugees.
Especially when the United States, you know, I know it's not going to be popular, but we are much more responsible for the instability that is going on in the Middle East than Sweden is. than Holland is.
Yeah, or Germany.
Yeah. So it's,
And the people you were with are, these are like working class people, right?
It's a mix. So the two guys who I couldn't figure out what in the world, how they fit together, turned out to be pastry chefs. Now, the one guy, the little skinny guy, was married and had three kids. And then the other guy, the big guy, was also like an amateur bodybuilder. So get in your mind, amateur bodybuilder who also loves to make like little cakes, which is, I think, the way, which is not how people think of Syrians, right. especially with the kind of rhetoric that you had going. So they were competing pastry chefs from the same small coastal town who had decided they were going to go to Sweden together and open the mother of all pastry shops, because one of them specialized in, you know, baklava and the Eastern kind of sweets, and the other was very good at Western kinds of ghettos, as they like to say. So those guys are not the same as, say, the Demosine family that was on the journey, which had university educations, the girls. The younger daughter had just finished her first year of art school at the University of Damascus. Her older sister had already graduated with a degree in English. Their mom was the daughter of Palestinian refugees, so she sort of captured that dynamic of having, you know, generational displacement. There's a mix. Listen, on the trail, we met people who knew exactly where they wanted to go. They were architects. They loved Reem Koolhaas, so they wanted to go to Holland. And then there were people who I think were probably illiterate in Arabic, so I don't know how they're really going to learn another language when they're not even literate in their own mother tongue. I mean, there really is a variety. And that is going to be something that the host countries are going to have to sort of figure out a way to sort out and figure out how do you integrate people who already have different levels of education, cosmopolitanism, exposure, acceptance of difference. It's a massive, massive experiment.
Remind me of the timeline of your book. You were in Syria in Damascus.
Everything starts going down in February of 2011, if
right.
you recall.
And when were you in Damascus?
And I was finishing up the book. I was editing this oral history book. I put everything in storage and was over there by April of 2011 in Damascus. And then I left finally in May of 2013.
What did people say it was like before all of that? I mean, it's a dictatorship. But what was daily life like for people in your family, people you talked to under Assad and his father in those all those years before that?
Well, I mean, I know what it was like because we used to go
visit
frequently,
yeah.
and I then used to work in the region. I was never, you know, listen, having been a human rights lawyer and then a journalist, these are occupations that are hazardous to your health in a dictatorship. So I never could work in Syria. So I already had an idea of what it meant to live under Assad. Basically, when you live in a dictatorship like that, there are things that are not going to change. There's stability, there's safety, crime is not tolerated. There's a predictability to life. There are certain rules of engagement. You don't dissent, you don't speak up, you go along to get along. And that's a decision that a lot of Syrians did make. And that's what you're seeing them sort of deciding to do now. They're going to kind of be forced to accept this regime staying because they want to be able to live in their country. And I understand why people made those decisions, because the regime had already very early on, remember, his father came to power in 1970, proven how ruthless they were willing to be in sort of cementing power. People had already paid. Hama, my grandmother's native town, had been leveled in the 80s because of their dissent. So people understood the price that there was to pay. So to me, it always looked like a circumvented life, right? There are things that, you know, to not be able to share your opinion. People in public never criticized anything because, as we were told, the walls even had ears. And, you know, if you understand what the Stasi were in East Germany, then that's also what you had going on in Syria, except where the Germans were precise because they're German. You know, the Syrians, what they lacked in precision, they more than made up with, you know, with zeal. And so they were brutal, sort of constant surveillance. But at the same time that, okay, you had this circumvented life, it also lived in some of the most beautiful cities in the world. I mean, Damascus, Aleppo, these are some of the oldest still existing cities in the world. You're also on the Mediterranean, Latakia, and some of the best striped bass you're ever going to have is on the coast there. The food is wonderful. It's the sort of a confluence of many different cultures. You have the Mediterranean, so touches of Greece and Rome. At the same time that you have the Iranian influences in Persia, you're not very far from North Africa. You also have the influence of Islam in the Arab Gulf. So, like, it and Turkey and the Ottoman Roman Empire. So it's really, it's an intoxicating mix. And the people are amongst some of the kindest you would have ever met. And there was a kind of cosmopolitanism in how diverse these places were that is also just being decimated as we speak.
In exploring your family, trying to understand who these people were, the ones you didn't know, more distant relatives and from previous generations, what would you say of all of those characters? Because some of the book reads like a novel.
Good. I'm glad to
hear
that.
Yeah, I know. An interesting family. But for you, what was the biggest revelation, would you say, in terms of that, in terms of looking at different characters in the family and what they did with their lives? Was it your grandmother, your grandfather?
Great-grandfather.
The great-grandfather.
Great-grandfather, the grandmother. You know, those people always sort of lived in the realm of legend because, you know, the ancestors, you know, you don't know them personally. So my great-grandfather, who I tell you very quickly, I think on the first page of the book, you know, he was very well known for his generosity and he had a few other wonderful attributes, but that the attribute that he was really quite well known for and it was spoken of so matter-of-factly was his womanizing. He was really quite a prolific womanizer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had heard about that. And so that, you know, but then understanding him against the backdrop of the times that he lived in, how he could be like that and sort of be betraying his wife, but also be serving a country as it was rebelling against the French and building itself. You know, these sorts of contradictions that you find in people, that's what I sort of found the most interesting. And I found them even in my own parents when I had to subject understanding my parents to, you know, they're no longer your parents when you are a journalist,
right?
And you make them characters and you have to understand them in that way. I learned a lot about them. You know, I spoke at the Mayborn Literary Conference in Texas a few months ago, and the woman who was moderating the panel, she said that somebody once said that to have a writer in the family is like having an assassin nearby.
What did your family make of the book?
Well, my immediate family has been quite supportive. I think because I'm fair, you know, I think the problem, especially when you are writing about Arabs or Muslims, people who have been so dehumanized, there's a temptation to make them flawless and perfect characters. But I think nobody would read that and find them believable. And I think everybody's a little bit good, a little bit bad, and a little bit ugly. And I think if you leave out the bad and the ugly, then you're really doing your readers and the story a disservice. So I think
I agree with you. But, you know, when you're writing about your family, especially people who are still living, you're taking some risk.
Yes.
And it takes a commitment to be the journalist.
Yes,
and
it does.
And do that.
I mean, there were points when I got notes back on chapters from my mom that, you know, we've become so used to emojis. I remember on one part, she made a cry face, upside down smiley, you know, and she just said...
You mean it just made her sad? Or
no, I mean, it was also sad to sort of realize...
You shouldn't be publishing it.
Oh, no. In the end, they were quite supportive, and I think they love the book.
Oh, so your mother never said, you know, she read a passage and said, take that out.
No. Yeah. No, I know there's some people that were a little unhappy from the more extended family, a little less happy about like the, you know, brutal honesty of like, say, the womanizing, or there's also a political murder that happens in our family. And, you know, there are people's, you know, instincts are to not say anything about it. So far, I've yet to be disinvited from anything, but I also have not been newly invited to anything. So I guess we'll see. I mean, listen, it is hard. It is hard to become the subject of somebody else's version of history. And it's powerful when you're allowed to write a book. And not everyone gets to write a book about it. So there will be those, I'm sure, who will resent me for it. And there, you know, that's why I change names and I try to disguise identities, because there are plenty of people still inside Syria.
When you're with the refugees, or when you just think about them, do you feel powerless, or do you feel like you've done your part here, or at least done something?
In many ways, of course, I do feel powerless, because it's been a long time. I never used to say stuff like, oh, no, the bad guys have won, or the bad guys are going to win. And it feels like everywhere in the world that we're in a little bit of that moment. I think there's always more that we can be doing. My family raises money every year for three different organizations that were founded by Syrians or Syrian Americans that we think do good work with refugees. I'm not fabulously wealthy, so I can't dump money into this problem, but I have been given a platform in which I can speak about people and try to represent their stories or amplify their voices. And that is what I am trying to do. Do I feel, though, like my book is 6 years too late? Oh, you know, completely. But the reality is I have been wanting to write a book about my grandmother in Syria for a long time, and there was only a market for it when the country fell apart. And
You're being honest.
Yeah.
On the publishing end of it,
of course,
you're probably correct.
Nobody was curious about a great family story about Syrians before. Yeah. That's the world that we live in.
Yeah. What a mess.
It is a mess.
It's a terrible mess.
It's a mess.
And think about the end game. I'm sorry to start you with the easy question in this interview, but it is what's been on everybody's mind who thinks about this.
Right.
I think a lot of Americans just rather not think about it.
A lot of people are sort of bemoaning the fact that Trump and our inward sort of like navel gazing that's going on in the United States has sort of sucked all the oxygen out of the room. Yeah. I don't have television, so whenever I'm in Baltimore, I watch TV because my parents have TV. And I mean, it's devastating that all anyone's ever talking about
is Trump.
Is Trump, and not the issues. And the thing is, you know, we were talking earlier about Italy, our mutual love for Italy. And I used to live in Italy. And the first time I moved to Italy in 1994 from Baltimore when I was a junior at Johns Hopkins, Berlusconi had just come into power. And he has been there for most of my relationship with Italy. And the Italians said, if you go back, there are a ton of articles and columns that came out by Italian writers in November of 2016 saying, now that you have your own version of Berlusconi, don't make our mistake. Don't always focus on the horror and the sort of salaciousness of how inappropriate the behavior is. Still focus on the issues. What is going on in the country? What are the sort of substantive policy things that we need to be talking about? And we're not, I don't know how we're almost, you know,
no, you're right.
9 months in.
That's good advice.
9 months in and we're just talking. I turn on the TV and they're still talking about whether or not Trump is mentally ill.
Yeah. Journalists in particular need to pay attention to that because actually, a lot of damage is being done in the administration while we're focused on his tweets.
Exactly. Yeah. And Berlusconi stayed in power for almost 20 years. Yeah. Actually, I'm trying to think, 1990, when did he finally force him out? Almost 20
close,
years.
You're close, yeah.
Yeah.
Aliyah Malik, it was nice to meet you. And I'll tell folks where they can find you this weekend at the Baltimore Book Festival.
Thank you.
Aliyah Malik is the author of The Home That Was Our Country, a memoir of Syria. She'll be at the Baltimore Book Festival this weekend on the Ivy Bookshop stage on Friday at 5 p.m. That's right near the Baltimore Visitor Center along the Inner Harbor Promenade. You can find links with more information about the festival and also a link to The Road to Germany, the story Aliyah Malik wrote for Foreign Policy, in the notes with this episode of Roughly Speaking. After a brief message, we'll get a short tutorial on Arabic music and hear about an upcoming concert to draw attention to the Syrian refugee crisis.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
There will be a Syrian refugee awareness concert September 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Harold J. Kaplan Concert Hall, Center for the Arts at Towson University. The free concert features the music you've been hearing on the show today from the Layali Arabic Music Ensemble. I spoke with the leader of the group, one of its founders, Michelle Mushabek, and got a bit of a tutorial on the instruments that make this arresting sound. First of all, I really enjoyed the music. We're going to listen to it a little bit here as we speak. But I had a couple of questions for you.
Go ahead.
What is a ney?
The ney is a very interesting instrument. It's a reed flute, and it's an ancient instrument, and it's played in our concerts as part of the ensemble by a Moroccan ney player. His name is Mohammed Majour. He's also a ney maker or a flute maker, and he's quite a brilliant exponent of Arabic classical repertoire, and really a leading interpreter of contemporary works in Arabic music. He's known for bringing the ney's hauntingly beautiful sounds to audiences all over the U.S. and Europe for now 30 or 40 years. He was born into a musical Berber family in Morocco.
Well, let's listen to some of that now. Okay. Next question, since I need to go through the glossary of musical terms from the Middle East. Tabla. Which is the tabla?
The tabla is a percussion instrument. It also has other names. In some cases, it's called the dumbek, and in others, it's called the darbuka. In Lebanon, they call it a darbuka. It's normally, traditionally, made out of clay, and the head of the tabla was made out of fish skin. But nowadays, they have perfected the technology, and it's made out of an aluminum alloy and some plastic skin that you can tune. In the old days, we were unable to tune these instruments, so when we play the concert, we used to have, you know, two or three tablas next to us sitting on a heat pad. And then after every piece, we will take the tabla on the heat pad and use it for the next piece. This way, the skin was always heated, was always tight.
Right.
Nowadays, of course, you know, we can tune these instruments.
Next to the tabla, is it the rick? R-I-Q-Q would be the spelling in English.
R-I-Q-Q is tambourine, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's a special tambourine. It's a tambourine that we play with both hands and with all fingers. So it's a very, very intricate and very, very highly skilled instrument to play. It's, again, it used to be made out of wood in the old days, and it has a five sets of double zills on the side, brass zills. And the skin also, again, was used to be fish skin, but now it's plastic, and we can tune this instrument. And we play both, you know, with all our fingers, both on the rim and on the skin on the inside, as well as on the zills on the side.
Next to that is the daff. Is it D-A-F-F?
D-A-F-F is a frame drum. Huh. Is a large, oversized frame drum.
Okay, and also in the ensemble we have the oud.
The oud is the lead instrument in the Arabic music. It's the instrument you compose on. It's like the piano in Western instrument. And it is an egg-shaped instrument. It's a string instrument. And, of course, in the West, when the Crusaders invaded the Middle East in the 11th, 12th century, they brought back this instrument with them that they didn't know how to play initially, and they called it the lute because they couldn't say the word oud. So the oud is the instrument that came from the Middle East to the West and was called the lute. And at that time, the lute, the oud, is a fretless instrument, so there are no frets on the oud. And but when it was brought into the West, musicians added frets so that they are able to play it here as a lute.
I have one more to ask you about, and I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but maybe kanun? Kanun.
The kanun is a zither-like instrument that you pluck, and a musician plucks. It's normally on the musician's lap. It has 78 strings, and it's plucked with two fingers.
I looked for commentary on Layali to see what others had to say about your music, and I noticed the word hypnotic.
It is. It's a word that is we see is used a lot, and what is responsible for this? You know, Arabic music, it is, it's quite distinct. You know, it has a distinct sound, an enveloping sound with unique melodies. It has a defining structure, and based on ancient modes that we call in Arabic the maqam. And the maqam is a conceptual organizational framework. You see, melody in Arabic music incorporates microtonality, which means that the intervals that we use do not conform to the half step or the half tone and the whole tone divisions of traditional Western music. Mm-hmm. And that's what really makes the feeling a soothing and a hypnotic feeling, because they, in Arabic music, the scales use quarter tones and sometimes even eighth tone and sixteenth tone.
Well, it does make for something highly unusual to the Western ear, and just
it
so
is, and I remind
so
listeners most of the time that, you know, if you've never listened to Arabic music before, rest assured that our instruments are not out of tune, but
within
a short period of time you will get used to it, and it will become, you know, quite pleasurable and addictive listening to that music.
Well, I did almost immediately upon hearing some of your recordings. Maybe the violin helps with that some.
It does, yes. And of course, in Arabic music, we have more than 20 scales or modes, and compared to the West traditional 12 scales. And it covers almost every emotion, from joy, sadness, meditation, ecstasy, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, would you just mind telling me a little bit about your own experience coming to the United States and forming Layali? How long has this ensemble been together?
The ensemble has been together for 25 years, and we're actually on a small musical tour, our 25th anniversary tour. And Layali is a Boston-based ensemble of very, very highly talented musicians, very, very passionate about Arabic music. And over the years, we have, you know, earned quite wide acclaim from ethnomusicologists and audiences, and we've performed at concert halls throughout the U.S. and internationally. The members of the ensemble have performed at places like the London's Peacock Theatre, Singapore's Victoria Theatre, Paris's La Salle Gaveau, in Italy and Germany, and at colleges and universities. We've performed extensively at universities in the U.S., from Yale University, Williams College, Amherst College, Boston University, Harvard, Hampshire College, Smith, and other places. And we're delighted to be coming to Maryland and performing at Towson University on September 29th. I've been a musician for nearly 40 years, yes. I mean, it was back home. I'm Palestinian, and I was born in Beirut, Lebanon, and I left Beirut during the Civil War in the late 70s, and I came here to study, and I went to New York University. I make my living as an editor and a book publisher, but it's my stress relief and my passion is also music. And 25 years ago, I was one of the founding members of the Layali Arabic Music Ensemble.
Well, congratulations on the anniversary. That's quite an achievement, 25 years. And just one last thing. You're coming here for a benefit concert, and I can imagine there's been a lot of demand for that in the last 5 years especially.
Well, we feel it's really important, really, because we're playing this Towson University concert as a Syrian refugee awareness concert. And we've been doing quite a number of those because we're very troubled by what's happening in the Syrian refugee crisis. The world has failed Syria's refugees, and some of the world's wealthiest countries have really turned their backs on this humanitarian disaster. And there's the need for food relief is great and growing, and one can't help but feel helpless in the face of a tragedy of this magnitude. So we've done a lot of these benefit concerts to raise awareness about the refugee crisis, but also hopefully to inspire others to do something and contribute and raise funds for organizations that are doing good work to relieve the suffering of Syrian refugees.
Thank you very much, Michel Mushabek. Nice to speak with you.
Great to speak to you, too. If I may say a couple of words about a project that we will be talking about at the performance at Towson University. As a book publisher, once a year we do a humanitarian project to give back to the community. And one book that we did in 2005 as a result of the refugee crisis is a cookbook called Soup for Syria. And this is a cookbook. We have asked 80 famous chefs to each contribute a soup recipe to this cookbook. And the proceeds of the sales from the sales of the cookbook, 100% of the proceeds, were going to UNHCR and SAMS, Syrian American Medical Society, for food and medical relief. And last year we have donated over $300,000 from the sales of this book for food relief. And if people would like to help, they can do that by purchasing copies of the cookbook, and they can find information on soupforsyria.com.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dan.
All right, Michel. Good luck.
Really appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Michel Mushabek is the leader of the Layali Arabic Music Ensemble. The troupe will give a concert on September 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the Center for the Arts at Towson University to raise awareness of the Syrian refugee crisis. In addition to the musicians, Rochelle Davis, Associate Professor of Cultural Anthropology at Georgetown, will give an overview of the crisis. The concert is free and open to the public. More information in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. For producers Steve Early and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.